Welcome to the Careers by Jen podcast, episode 239. This time on the podcast, Jen speaks with Sean Webb on how to hack happiness when you don't know any Russians.
You're listening to the Careers by Jen podcast. I'm your host, Jen Swanson. This is the podcast that helps you to get the job, love your work, and advance your career. Careers by Jen is a listener-sponsored podcast, and if you like the content, please consider supporting the show as a patron. You can do so for as little as $1 a month. Head over to careersbyjen.com and click on support to learn more. Hey friends, thanks for tuning in. One thing I haven't done for a really long time is to share the Apple Podcast reviews, so I thought I'd start right off the top by sharing two with you today. And the first one is titled, "So Crucial for So Many of Us Asleep at the Career Wheel. This show is awesome, so helpful to help us wake up and get into the career path we really want to be on. We spend so much time not doing what we truly want and often not even being awake enough to realize it. Jen has great guests on to help us figure this stuff out and build a career that speaks to our true potential and interests." And that was from B Dizzle Fizzle, and I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for leaving that review. The second one I want to share with you is entitled "Awesome!" Exclamation. "Jen, what a great show, from the Vader intro guy to your content. Love it." And that was from somebody whose name is DSALT00 via Apple Podcasts. So thanks again so much for leaving the reviews. It helps to spread the show, bump it up in the ratings, and share it. And I very, very much appreciate it. If you'd like to leave a review and hear it read on air, please go over to Apple Podcasts when you're finished listening to this episode and share the love. All right, today's episode is called Hacking Happiness. And my guest, Sean Webb, is a powerhouse. He is a speaker. He's the author of, I think, three books. I know for sure two, but I thought I saw three online. And he calls himself a guide to helping people supercharge their minds. And I began our conversation by asking, what does it mean to hack happiness?
Wow. Okay. Well, there's a really complex answer and a really simple answer to that. The fact is that our nervous systems are the culprit when we're talking about our experiences of our positive and negative emotions in life, right? And every emotion that you have ever and will ever have in your life is created by your nervous system, which is designed to help you make the right choices and go in the right direction based on its brain's function of helping you survive from one day into the next. And so hacking happiness is a really simple task and a really complex task at the same time. The simple task is to grab hold of one of the two variables that come together to create every one of your emotional reactions that you've had from the time of your birth on through the time of your death, and mess with one of those. And when you mess with one of those two variables, it literally changes your emotional landscape based on what you do with one of those two variables. It's like a sneeze. You can't even stop it from happening. Your brain simply reacts based on how you adjust one of those two variables. Now, it's a lot more complex in that there are a lot of malleability points in each one of these variables that can get pretty deep at times, but you can start from a very shallow level to grab something like your expectation or preference about something or your perception about something, which are the two variables, and tweak it to get a totally different output from your brain. Because if you think about it, happiness and all of your emotions, like you can take control of fear, you can take control of anger, you can take control of sadness, all of your emotional reactions come from your brain. It's not that you've set life's external conditions to make yourself happy, that you've got the new car, or the bigger house, or whatever it is. It's the fact that your brain likes that you got the new car, or the new house, or the new spouse, or the, you know, new whatever it is that you then have a happy reaction to. So the last step in that process is always your mind. And so if you can take control of the variables that then tick that last little button to create that happiness, that's what hacking your mind is, or hacking happiness is all about, is you take control of those things and you say, well, I don't have to set my external variables anymore. All I have to do is figure out how to press that button in my brain that brings me happiness. And if you figure out how to do that, which is totally possible, I explain it in the books that I wrote, then your life is transformed. And this dates back thousands of years to the old men in long white beards sitting on a mountain explaining how to do this internally, etc. It turns out that science is now uncovering all of these cool little secrets that help us get there as well. So,
yeah, science seems to be catching up with the ancient wisdom, doesn't it?
Yeah. It totally is. And ironically, or not ironically, I mean, thankfully, it's science is proving that those guys were right, which is amazing, right? You know, so you read these old texts and old lessons from the Buddha or Lao Tzu or Jesus or Muhammad, and you know, their wisdom is being proven scientifically correct in the labs of the world, which is really, really cool.
It is fantastic. I've been doing a whole lot of reading and studying on things like meditation and doing meditation. And I've interviewed a couple of neuroscientists on the topic. And the whole thing about the mind and how we can actually change it, epigenetics and neuroplasticity and all that stuff, is just fascinating to me. And,
yes.
And you know, the idea that you need to have external stuff to make you happy, I'll be happy when, or, right, you know, once I get to X, I'll be happy, is just bunk.
It's a lie.
Yeah.
It's a big unnecessary step. I mean, not that that stuff couldn't work, and it does work. I mean, when you win the lottery, you get about a year of increased happiness before your nervous system normalizes, which is what the nervous system is designed to do, by the way. It's like you get comfortable sitting in your chair, and then all of a sudden you don't feel it anymore. Or you wake up in the middle of the night and you smell the gas, and then you walk around for 10 minutes, and then you don't smell the gas anymore. You go to bed and it kills the whole family. Well, that's your nervous system normalizing to the change in the environment, because all your nervous system does is just report on the differences. So you can set those external conditions that'll create a happiness for a short time for you, but then it's going to normalize. And so you got to figure out a better way rather than be on the hedonic treadmill of always needing the bigger, better, always needing the next good thing. That's the one that'll drive you into the ground. Right.
I was trying to remember the word as you were saying it. It's that hedonic principle. Absolutely.
Yeah. 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 What you're looking for is eudaimonia instead of hedonia, right? Hedonia is that nervous system thing that says, oh, this is better than the last one and I'll be happy for a little while. And there's a different type of happiness within you. That's the eudaimonia that, the Greeks and Romans identified that, is different. It's the wellspring of goodness, if you're into the ancient texts, that is ever flowing.
So how does a person begin to take control of the mind when often people are asleep at the wheel, and I'm speaking, including myself, until I started learning about this stuff, and just reacting to what happens on a case-by-case basis. So how does somebody take control and realize and recognize and begin to understand that happiness doesn't happen from outside?
Well, it's simple. You start with baby steps. And the baby steps that anyone can start with is simply understanding the process of how their mind works and what their mind uses to create the emotional landscape that they then experience within, based on all the stuff that's going on around them. It's never, you know, what's going on around you. It's always your internal reaction that creates that experience that you have. Like if you see something that makes you angry, the last step in that process is that it ticks that button in your brain that makes you angry within, based on what you've seen. And you can put an intervention into that process that allows you the control of just making a decision of whether or not, maybe if I get ticked off a little bit, will it be useful for me? Will it be productive? Will it give me the energy to be able to take an action? Like, you know, if somebody comes to me and says, you know, I like the Chicago Cubs, right? If somebody comes to me and says, oh, the Chicago Cubs suck. Okay, so if I get angry at that, is that going to be useful? I'm going to get in an argument with this person about how, no, they're great, they just fell apart at the last part of the season, whatever it is, that I try to have a defensive self mechanism put into place. Or would it be better for me to save that anger and that energy for when someone comes and slaps my son in the face for absolutely no reason and I need to put him on the ground and use that adrenaline rush, you know, that type of thing. So the baby steps is for you to figure out and understand how your mind works in the basic generation of your emotional reactions and the experiences that you have as a result of what's going on around you. Now, the cool thing that happens at that point, when you understand how your mind works, two awesome things happen and you can't even stop them from happening. It's a physiological reaction. The first thing that happens when you learn how your mind works and how your brain or your mind puts together the emotional reactions that you have is that it gives you a little bit of a distance in a perception space between you and what's going on from the reaction of your mind itself. So like right now, most people are in the space listening to this that they have a reaction to something, sadness, fear, anger, whatever it is. And their perception of self is that I am that anger, right? They don't think of it this way, but it's like, I am this anger at the moment. I am this sadness at the moment. I am this fear at the moment. And they're in a reactivity mode that they then have to beholden to that reaction. Well, when you learn how your mind works and you can see it from a small distance away, just like a fingertip can't touch itself or an eyeball can't see itself without some distance in a mirror, a taste bud can't touch itself, an olfactory nerve can't smell itself, there needs to be some distance between a perceiver and a perceived. Otherwise, you can't perceive it. And so one of the things that happens in your mind is when you understand that two basic components that come together to create all of your reactions in life about everything, is that it gives you some distance from the reaction itself and your perception of it. And so your mind, there's this portion of your mind, the subconscious process within your mind that says, okay, I'm the person who's, or I'm the level of consciousness that's supposed to take care of our sense of self. And let me back up just a second to say your brain is your organ of survival. And there's this thing called the limbic system, which is always scanning your environment for threats because your brain is the organ of survival. It's supposed to help you survive from yesterday into tomorrow. Well, you have to figure out the threats in the world to be able to do that. But a second question then must be asked, a threat to what? And that's where your sense of self comes in. Okay, so if you see a leaf cutter ant over there on the ground, you need to figure out whether you have leaves or not to understand whether that leaf cutter ant is a threat. If you have leaves and it is a threat, you need to move away. If it's not, you don't need to waste the energy because you're a finite energy creature to allow that ant to just go do its thing. So then your sense of self is this other half of your existence that needs to be set. Well, when you create that space of perception in between an emotional reaction and you're perceiving it, that layer that keeps the definition of self, which must be accurate, else you die, you know, by not having a good definition of who and what you are, that layer of subconscious then says, wait a second, I thought I was that anger. I thought I was that sadness. I thought I was that fear, but now I can see it. And so that means I'm not. And so that expands your sense of self out a little bit. And there are tons of studies on reactions to sense of awe or a larger, expansive, unitive experience changing people's lives en masse. Well, that does that from a little miniature perspective. And every time you do that, it expands out your sense of self. Every time you can see your mind in its processing, that expands your sense of self out just a little bit. But the more and more you do it, the larger your sense of self gets. And then all of a sudden, this little mud puddle that was your sense of self, when you have a life problem rock that falls into it and it splashes water out and makes you feel smaller than you were, and maybe rocks your boats or sinks one of them, whatever it is that's going on in your life, all of a sudden that little mud puddle of self expands out into a pond of self, and then expands out into a lake of self, expands out into an ocean of self. And then all of a sudden that same life problem rock falls into your body of water and you don't even notice the ripples, right? It's, you handle those things much easily. Well, when you see your mind in play, when you see your mind creating your emotional reactions live, gives you that space to say, okay, I'm more than just this mind's reaction. So now this anger that I had about this report at work or this email that I just got or this headline that I just read or whatever it is that's on my social media feed that I want to get into this long, drawn-out argument on Facebook now, all of a sudden you have the perspective to say, wait a second. I don't necessarily have to react to that. I'm going from a position of compulsion to choice. Rather than being controlled by the emotional reaction, now I get a choice. Now I get a little bit of a freedom. I get a little bit of a liberation to say, I don't have to actually react the way I would have reacted yesterday to that. Because I understand this now, I see exactly the two variables that are coming together to create this reaction. Now I can make a decision of whether or not I want to spend any energy on this. Now, the second cool thing that happens when you figure out how your mind works is that there's actually a hardwired circuit in your brain. And they found this in 2007, Matt Lieberman at UCLA in an fMRI machine. He put a bunch of folks in an fMRI and he said, I'm going to show you some pictures. I want you to just react to these pictures. Let's look at them. And he was looking at their brains while they were doing this. And so he showed them a bunch of emotionally charged pictures of anger, fear, sadness, whatever it was. And the reaction of the study participants was exactly what they expected it to be. It was their brains lit up in those areas based on their empathy circuits, based on our mirror neurons that fired those fear circuits, that fired those sadness circuits. Even though we didn't really feel it from a, you know, waking perspective, the brain said, hey, that's fear. Ooh, should we be fearful about something, right? And so they saw it on the fMRI. And so what he did with the second group is he said, okay, I'm going to put you in here now, and I want you to name the emotion in play. That's all I want you to do. Just name anger, fear, sadness, whatever it is. Just name it. And what they found, and they created a number of copycat studies all over the world because universities were like, holy crap, this is amazing, is that when a person put a cognitive understanding, just a cognitive process of their prefrontal cortex of naming the emotion, the negative emotion turned off in real time, and they saw it live on the fMRI. The amygdala downregulated immediately. And so it was a physiological response that the brain stopped sending the signal of the emotion to the front of the brain. The brain said, hey, okay, I got the message. I understand what it is. And it turned off the limbic system in response. Now, this is, you know, really cool science, but if you think about it, this is exactly the way we experience the world from a day-to-day basis. Like when you walk by a coil on the ground, and you're not certain whether it's a hose or a snake, your limbic system will automatically react and say, oh my God, this is a snake. And then you jump, right? Well, that's your limbic system creating a perception that says that could be a threat to me. That coil on the ground could be a threat to me. And you jump, right? This is the thing that jerks our head out of the way when a baseball comes flying at us. Like it's the quickest reaction center in the brain. Now, what happens though, is when you look down and you see it's a hose, your prefrontal cortex says, I understand. You may have jumped the gun on that. Thank you very much. Got the message, but not a snake. It's a hose. And so then a signal is sent from the medial prefrontal cortex and the right ventral lateral prefrontal cortex back to the limbic system and says, okay, we're good. Turn the fear off. And the fear turns off immediately. It's the same exact circuit that Matt Lieberman found in the fMRI and UCLA to say, I understand this emotion. We understand what's going on. Thank you for the message, but we don't need it anymore. And so the limbic system turns off because it doesn't want to waste energy either. It just wants to protect us, but it's not going to protect us if it's wasting energy sending us a message of fear when there needs to be no fear. So what happens when you're able to understand your mind from a perspective of knowing the components that come together to create all of your emotional responses, and especially an emotional response that you're experiencing at the moment in a situation where you've just gotten that email, or you've just seen that headline, or you've just witness the results of the report, or you've just been handed a big torpedo on your big project at work or whatever it is, you can understand the reaction that your limbic system is sending. And by the way, your emotional brain turns off your prefrontal cortex. So like 150 years ago, when a bear walked out of the woods and your prefrontal cortex, your thinking brain was shut off to give you energy to your legs so you could run, that was great 150 years ago. But now when our problems are coming in on emails and spreadsheets and social media feeds and all this other stuff, it's like you need your thinking brain to get out of the emotional reaction in the first place. That whole process of your emotional brain shutting down your thinking brain, not so good for us anymore. Right? So at that moment that you can understand the two variables that came together to create your acute emotional response, that actually starts to shut that reaction off, and you start to get your thinking brain back, and it gets the emotion out of your way so that you can then think your way out of the solution or out of the situation that you found yourself in, which is amazing. I mean, and it's like a sneeze. You can't even stop it from happening. At the moment that you understand and put a cognitive process to your emotional process, it shuts it off, which is really cool, which is what the Matt Lieberman Name It, Tame It studies found that Dan Siegel now travels the world talking about, because he's the whole 20-minute portion of his talk is about Name It, Tame It. And he's taught with the Dalai Lama before, which is really cool. Dan and I had breakfast a couple of years back. That's exactly what happens, is that when you understand exactly what's going on in your mind, it creates the space between you and the reaction of your mind. So then now you're moving from compulsion into choice. And then also it's turning it off, saying, let's give you a little bit more control of your prefrontal cortex. Let's give you a little bit more control of your executive function so that you can make a decision that isn't emotionally based.
So Sean, when you're in the moment, when someone said something awful to you at work or you've received that email, how do you know what to say or what to do to make that shut off?
Well, it's an internal process and it takes practice, right? So, and this can... We can use the adult learning model for this to explain the answer to this question, really, because, you know, a lot of people in the listening audience right now and a lot of people in the world, because this is brand new stuff, are in the place of an unconscious incompetence, which is where the adult learning model starts. And so you don't even know what you need to know. You don't even know what you don't know. It's like, you know, the first time I went to college, I figured out how much stuff I didn't know when I thought I knew everything when I was, you know, graduating high school. I was like, oh my God, what are you talking about? There are 40,000 majors that I can choose from or whatever, you know, all these different things that I would then have to spend 4 years learning. So, you know, there comes a point of unconscious incompetence where you don't know what you don't know, but then you pick up a book and then you figure out, oh, okay, there's some stuff that I could learn that might help me. And then you move into a conscious incompetence, where at least you know what it is that you need to learn to help you move forward in whatever it is you want to do. Then you start to read the book and you start to pick up the easy to understand concepts and things that click with you, et cetera. And you're able to start using those things. And then you move into a conscious competence where you know what to do. You know the steps you need to take. You know the stuff you need to know, but you really got to think about it. It's a conscious effort. It's a, okay, at this moment, I've got to look at my expectation and preference. I've got to understand what it is on my self map that's being attacked at the moment. I got to understand my perception that came in and why I thought that was an attack, which has created the anger, you know, that type of thing. And you'll understand this stuff if you pick up the Mind Hacking Habitus Red Book. But basically, if you identify those things, you're consciously taking those steps to say, okay, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to turn down my emotional reaction in the moment. I'm going to give myself a minute to let my reaction wane a little bit. But then you move into the plasticity that you'd mentioned previously, where your brain actually changes in form and function over time based on how you use it. And this is real world science, right? This all started with the studies about the cab drivers in London called the Knowledge, right? The cab drivers in London, they have 100,000 points of interest in London with like 2,500 city streets that they have to memorize. And all of these streets have different routes and different traffic patterns. And some of them move one way in the early portion of the day, and they move the other way in the later portion of the day. And you have to memorize it all to be able to get a cab driver's license in London. They studied these guys or these people before they got their cab driver's license, and their hippocampus and their memory centers, their brain grew in size in both gray matter and white matter based on the people who passed the test. So it's like they have before and after shots of the brain. Your brain will change, just like you get better at crossword puzzles over time when you practice, just like you get a bit better at playing the piano over time with practice, or shooting a basketball or whatever it is you want to do. Your brain will help you transfer a lot of the stuff that was conscious into the subconscious. And this is where, you know, the Tiger Woods of the world start to emerge, or the LeBron James, where it's just lights out. It's just they're operating at a different level where their subconscious has taken over and they're just performing, and they've gotten their thinking mind out of the way. And so you can do that with happiness. You can do that with negative emotion regulation. And over time, you get so good at it that all of a sudden, you know, that email comes in, or that your boss's statement comes in, or whatever it is that could throw you into a tizzy, all of a sudden you immediately see it.
you immediately react to it subconsciously, and all of a sudden it becomes an optional reaction for you, to where you can either use it or not use it based on your experience. And so as a beginner, you've got to basically learn the tools and use the tools from that conscious competence perspective. It's got to be, okay, so this email just pissed me off, or whatever it was. What is the thing on my self map that is being attacked or being challenged at this moment? Because it's got to be something that I'm attached to, right? The science of that, let me explain that really simply so that people can understand it. Your sense of self comes from the thing that must be protected, right? If we expand the leaf cutter ant example of whether or not you have leaves to you see an email about a certain project, well, whether or not you are attached to that project will determine whether or not you have a reaction to that project's announcement or email or whatever it is. And so if things land on your self map, and this goes back to a science that was proven by UVA, Jim Cohn, got a set of folks into an fMRI and said, okay, we're going to give you a flashlight and your glasses, and then we're going to zap your ankle. And then he watched the brain in between. And so the first group, he said, okay, we're going to zap your ankle. And he gave him the flash of light. He saw the fear center light up in the brain, and he zapped the ankle, which I thought was pretty cool. I had to pop some popcorn, sold the cable rights. the next group he brought in, he said, okay, we're going to zap you. We're going to keep you in the fMRI. We're going to give you the flash of light. We're going to keep you in the fMRI. We're going to take the ankle zapper off, and we're going to put it on a stranger. And so at that point they thought, okay, we're not having a threat to self, because they thought the body was just the self. And so we're not going to see any fear. And what they saw was no fear. They're like, you guys are a bunch of masochists. You want to see the stranger zapped, right? Fine, no problem. They didn't see any fear in the people who are in the fMRI, because they weren't going to be zapped. But then they did something really interesting, which opened the whole world up regarding understanding of how the self works in the mind, is that they brought a familiar in, which is a person you care about, like a significant other or a friend or something like that. And they put the ankle zapper on that friend or that loved one, whatever it was. And they gave the person the flash of light in the fMRI, and they couldn't tell the first scan from the third scan apart. Wow. It was exactly the same areas of the brain that lit up in fear that the sense of self was going to be attacked. And so they proved that other people, and this is why we have emotion reactions to other people, or about news with other people's lives, is that those people become mapped onto our sense of self. Okay. And then Tiffany Burnett White at UIUC proved that self brand connection, Apple, Android, Ford, Chevy, Spurs, Knicks, you know, whoever it is, become attached to our sense of self as well, which is why you have reactions to the sports section in the newspaper, or the political headlines on your Facebook feed, or whatever it is that you have reactions to. You get attached to these certain things, and then the perceptions that come in from the world become attacks on your sense of self. It's the same exact wiring that's very simple in our brain, but it's the complexity becomes in the things that you get attached to, right? And so when you have, and then, you know, Sam Harris is a little extra tidbit. Sam Harris proved that religion and politics and other things, basically ideas get attached to our sense of self. So projects at work become attached to our sense of self, or our income, our ideas of what that means for our freedom, or our expectations about vacation, or our expectations about whatever is going on at work, or how somebody is treating us, or whether or not we get the promotion or not. All of these things land on our sense of self. So anything that comes in from the external world that affects one of these things on your sense of self then will evoke an emotional response. And if you understand just that much right there, you're ahead of the game. Because that is creating that space in between you and the emotion reaction, where you understand, oh, this is a process of my brain that I don't necessarily have to use if it's not going to be productive for me. And that, because these things, these emotional reaction things, can ruin a career. I mean, you send off the wrong email, or you copy the wrong people because you're pissed off about whatever, all of a sudden you're that person. And you don't want to be that person, right? You don't want to be that the HR has the eye on you, right? I say that because my wife's HR of a huge corporation. You don't want to be in her radar. And so you want to be able to have the control over those reactions. Well, at the point that you understand the things that land on your self map, and you can look at those, like, that's your first step. that's the first step of being able to say, okay, I'm having an emotional reaction of anger at the moment. I'm not going to send an email to hands off the keyboard, right? I'm not going to have a reaction. Let's look at that. Let's look at the thing that's on my self map that triggered me into this reaction. And what was my perception? Like, you know, maybe an email that came in is very clear. It's an attack on the project that you're working on, says you don't deserve the budget for whatever it is, or maybe you don't deserve the promotion, or maybe it's a positive thing about somebody else getting a promotion that you want, whatever it is. That's going to be an attack that's pretty clear in your mind. Maybe there's some room to see it a different way. Like, for instance, if somebody cuts you off in traffic, if you see it as a slight on you and they're more important than you are, or where they're going is more important than you are, you're going to have an anger reaction to it. Then if you perceive that person to be on their way to the hospital to see a loved one for the last time who's about to die, then you're going to be like, please take my lane, right? I give them a hug for me. You know, it's like, that's going to be the difference between a totally different emotional reaction to the same exact event. So if you've got something coming into your environment that you see a certain way, well, then you need to figure out, okay, what is it on my self map? What is it, the exact thing that I'm attached to mentally that has caused this emotional reaction? And at that point, you're ahead of the game, because that's creating that name-it-tame-it response from your prefrontal cortex to say, I'm putting a cognitive process to my emotional process. The emotion's going to turn down a little bit, may not turn off all the way, but you're going to get a higher level of handle on it. You're going to get a higher level of understanding, and your brain is going to physiologically help you get control of that situation, where before you knew any of this stuff about emotions and how your brain worked, you would have been totally out of control and torpedoing your career, where now you at least got a good handle on what to do. Now, you know, the next steps, of course, then are to take that into the mind of the people that you're dealing with. Because, you know, this raises your emotional intelligence. It raises your emotional intelligence for yourself. But you got to remember, the person at the next cubicle, the person who's in the corner office, the executive at the top of the company, their brain works exactly the same way as yours. And their mind works exactly the same way as yours. They may be attached to different things. They may have a different sense of self. They may be looking at all the different projects that they're overseeing versus the one that you're overseeing, or whatever it is. So you need to understand and look from their perspective on what they want to see. But you can then build perceptions in their mind that make them happy. And then you're the person who gets the promotion because you understand how the game works in their nervous system. And if you want to understand how important emotional intelligence is, this is on my desk, even though it was published like 3 years ago. This is the Harvard Business Review's magazine that says emotional intelligence is the essential ingredient to success. And understand, these guys are scientists. They never say anything definitive about anything. They always say, this study suggests that, you know, this might be the case, or this evidence leads us to think that. But right on the cover of the magazine, they said emotional intelligence is the number one ingredient to success, because you got to be able to manage your own mind. And you got to be able to manage the minds of the people around you. And if you understand the emotional reactions of the people around you, you can work with them a lot better. So
Daniel Goleman has been saying that for years.
Oh, totally. And he's right. He's right. He is definitely spot on that. And I just, you know, we needed to lay out the details of why that's true. And we needed to lay the scientific trail out to convince people why that's true. And so that's kind of what I did with Mind Hacking Happiness.
So getting from recognizing that your brain's been hijacked, giving yourself that space before you choose how to react, how does that relate to happiness?
Well, the basic function of your equation of emotion, right? There's only two variables that come together. And when those two variables are in imbalance, then that creates a negative emotion that you have to deal with. And when those two variables are in balance, then that creates a positive emotion. And there are a number of positive emotions, but you can generally say, you know, you're happy. Anticipation could be a future happiness, or anticipating a future happiness, et cetera. So your ability to be able to manage these variables will define whether or not you're feeling a negative emotion about something or a positive emotion about something. And so you can literally change the variables to balance them more and create a happiness for yourself in a situation where your brain might not want to give you happiness.
I have another question about neurological loops. So often we will have this old pattern grooved into our brains.
Yeah.
You know, something happens and we go into that old loop and recall all the things that have been done to us over, you know, with the litany of things, the list of transgressions, and we go into that same old thing and the same old emotions come up. How do you break that?
Okay. So what you're doing is you're pulling things. Now that your equation of emotion is very simple. We talked about the two variables, your expectation or preference of the next moment is expanded or expounded upon by then everything that your self map is connected to has an expectation or preference. And the basic rule is everything on your self map has to be held at status quo or increased in value, or we're going to have a problem. So anything that is important to you in your life has to be cool, or then we need to change something. And that starts at homeostasis, which governs every one of our cells in our body, and then kind of reverse cascades up. And that's how our self map items then get the expectation or preference over here that says everything has to be good on this self map, or we're going to have a problem. And then the perception side comes in that says, okay, this has attacked my project at work, or this has attacked my self value in my position at work, or this is attacked, you know, maybe layoffs are coming. I have a perception now that, you know, my entire job might be in jeopardy. That's a big attachment because it's connected to your income. It's connected to the ability to go to the movies. It's connected to, you know, a whole bunch of stuff that has associations. So what you're doing in that instance is you're bringing up past perceptions that then get processed as an equation of emotion in real time in your brain. And then you have an emotional reaction associated with that, right? Because that's just how your nervous system works. So you can practice stopping bringing that old crap up, or what you can do is you can change your sense of self. And this goes back to what you were talking about with meditation. And this goes back to understanding how your human mind works and expanding your sense of self out. Like, you know, rather than be just this little thing right here, you start to expand your sense of awe. You start to experience different things. You start to, explore the inner dimensions of your mind, and your sense of self expands outward. All of a sudden, those little perceptions that are over here don't bother the bigger sense of self. Like, they may still irk you just a little bit. Like, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if that person didn't say this about me 2 years ago or whatever it was? But here's the reality on bringing old stuff up. You need to forgive yourself. Like, and I say that just to cut to the chase, because forgiving other people isn't forgiving other people. Like, if somebody said something about you a year ago, or even 5 minutes ago, you're not going to be truly forgiving them when you forgive them. You're forgiving yourself. You're forgiving the memory of that causing any more turmoil for you, because you think they really care about how you felt about what they said. I mean, maybe there'll be a subset of folks who are really good folks who just unintentionally said something that pushed you the wrong way, and they're sorry about it, and you'll get an apology later, which will make you feel better. And why? Because that erases the perception that you had that they actually meant that statement, that they mean, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way, or whatever. And then all of a sudden, okay, that doesn't exist anymore, and you can let it go. You think they really care if they said something nasty to you of how you feel about it? No. So the only person who's going to feel nasty about it is you. And right. You're the only one that's got any negativity connected with that. So when you're talking about forgiving someone of something, you're really forgiving yourself. You just got to wipe it off of your memory map, your things that you hold on to, because those, you know, your past experiences become a portion of your sense of self. So every time that comes up into your equation of emotion, then it's going to create that emotional reaction, like including good stuff too. Like, you know, the last time you got a great award or whatever it was. You just got to wipe that stuff clean, and you got to say, okay, what's going on right now? What can I do right now to make my life better, to make myself happier? Because rehashing that old stuff, that's your default mode network. And the science shows that when you're firing in your default mode network about the things that are connected with your self map and what I should have said in this argument, or what I should have said in that email, or how I should have handled this, that's, you're being 20% less happy scientifically. Huh. Proven. Like, you're taking 20% of your happiness right. So you're going from an A to a C in happiness, like right off the top, anytime that you're doing that. So you just got to stop that practice, and you got to use your meta awareness, which is, you know, we didn't use that word yet, but anytime that you look at your two variables
of what's going on in your mind to create an emotional reaction, you're dumping yourself into this place called meta awareness, which is the place of you're taking your mind and you're turning back in on itself. And you're saying, okay, what is my mind doing? And it's an awareness of your awareness. That's what meta is. Meta is above, and awareness is, you know, just awareness. So it's above awareness. It's an awareness of what you're looking at. It's an awareness of what you're being aware of. So anytime that you stop yourself and say to yourself, okay, I'm not going to use that memory to rehash something that happened yesterday. What's going on right now? Right. And let's not make it the thought of what happened 2 years ago. Right. Let's take that and dump ourselves into meta awareness. And meta awareness is the science behind meditation. It's the science behind, you know, breathing. It's the science behind journaling. It's the science behind it's putting your attention on something that has your attention. So in that mindfulness. It's a mindfulness. It's the science of mindfulness, basically. Anytime you're doing that, you're doing positive things to your brain. You're doing positive things to your health. You're doing positive things to your immune system. You're doing positive things to your emotional well-being. So anytime you start into that loop, you got to stop, use the tools that I presented in Mind Hacking Happiness to say, okay, what's going on with this thought? Why do I keep bringing this up? What is it on my self-map that just really needs to be heard? And by the way, there's some science in the Mind Hacking Habits Blue Book, which is the second half of the, like, I wrote this one big book, and it basically turned into be too huge. And the editor was like, no, we got to chop that down the middle. So it was like volume one and volume two. Volume two goes into, or actually it's always also in volume one, we're journaling. It's the exercise of being heard. Like your immune or your nervous system wants to send a signal to from somewhere, from one point of the brain to the other, but it's got to have a signal back to say, okay, we get it, before it stops sending signals. And so you have unresolved emotional trauma from being a child or whatever it is, or last week's board meeting or whatever has come up in your life. You need to be able to get that nervous system portion that's wanting to send that signal. You need to get that to be heard. And so that's why the science of journaling is amazing, because when you start journaling and writing about something, you get it out onto the piece of paper. Well, all of a sudden that tricks that little button into saying, okay, I've been heard. And it stops sending the signal to say, man, that board meeting so sucked, or man, that email so sucked. If you're journaling about it, it gets it out onto the piece of paper, clicks that little button that says, okay, I've been heard, and it stops sending the signal. That's what's called being resolved. The emotional pain is resolved, and it stops being a pain in your life, which is an amazing place to be.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
So tell me, Sean, why do you love this stuff so much?
I love it because I think we're ready for humanity 3.0, right? I look at this thing from a big picture. The reason that we argue with each other on Facebook about whatever it is because of this process. And if we put a perception and an understanding and a cognition to this process, we aren't controlled by this process as much. But then that expands up into why warlords stop the food aid from getting to the people who want it the most, because they want to sell it off for profit to buy their guns or whatever it is. It's like their sense of self. They want to expand their personal goals, and they're controlled by this same process. And the reason that we lob bombs over borders at each other is basically for this same exact process. And I think we're ready for the next transition. Like humanity 1.0 is when we were hunter-gatherers and trying to figure out food and survival, et cetera. Humanity 2.0, okay, now we're building buildings. We're figuring out food distribution. We're not quite feeding the world yet, but we've figured out a way that we don't have to survive every day, which is why our art is beautiful, because we're spending time doing stuff that isn't, you know, growing food or defending against something that's supposed to kill us. It's why we love sports. It's why we love music. It's why we love all the things that we do in our spare time when we don't have to focus on survival. That's humanity 2.0. I think we're ready for humanity 3.0, which is that place where we actually get over that internal process that drives us and controls us, and then we take control of it. Like we go from the entity being on the leash of our minds to having our minds be on that leash. I think we're ready for that transition. That's what drives me every day, because when we can get more people on that boat, that's when we start to solve the problems of, well, you know, it'd be great if we could feed the world, but I need my second house. We can get over that stuff and start feeding the world. We can get over the need to create war over a monetary system or a governmental system or a religion or whatever it is that we're attached to that somebody else may not be attached to. That's humanity 3.0. That's what drives me.
Mm. And how did you get into this? Just tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, I found some success at a very young age. And I was hired by a big supercomputing company before I even graduated college and was making a lot of money and bought this amazing house when I was 27 in the upper middle class suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. And I was, it's like I had the convertible Firebird, banana yellow classic car. I had the speedboat. I had the fast motorcycle. I had the Grand Cherokee thing that I always wanted. Had an amazing house and the double lot. Has about to have a stereo delivered that was being hooked up right before a party of, you know, we're going to fill the house with friends. I had good romantic relationships. I had what I thought was a great relationship with a higher power. And when I was out on the porch, I looked out over all of this stuff that I had attained after being risen, you know, after being raised in poverty. Like 10 years previous, I was the poorest kid on the planet. And then 10 years later, I had achieved the American dream. And there was a sense of dread that came along with this thought in my head and said, what's next? You know, and I was thinking, wow, well, I could put a gazebo over there on the lawn and, you know, hook it up to the sound system. Oh, that would be amazing to sit out there and, you know, have a fire or whatever. But I thought that's not the answer. Like that's the hedonic treadmill. And I was just starting to wake up to that hedonic treadmill to say, that's not where this is coming from. That's like, okay, I have everything that the American dream has told me I should have, and I'm still not happy. There's something fundamentally wrong with that. And so I thought, all right, well, you have a mind for solving complexity. Let's figure this out. And so then I started to do a lot of introspection and I started to do a lot of reading. I started to do a lot of studying and including, you know, with meditation and things like that. And I started to expand consciousness and I found this place within the mind that, you know, there are multiple levels of consciousness that we have. It's why we laugh at our own jokes. It's because there are multiple delineations of consciousness within the brain that one portion of your brain tells a joke and then another portion laughs at it because it didn't know the joke in the first place. Otherwise you wouldn't laugh. Right. So, I've started to dive into consciousness expansion and exploration and found this place within the human mind that allowed for almost infinite expansion, which basically answered all the questions I had ever wanted to ask. And so within our own minds, and a lot of us know this already because, you know, even Einstein talked about where our discovery and where our creativity and where our answers come from. It's never we figure it out. It's always we sit with the problem. You know, somebody else hands us a problem. We think about it for a while, but then all of a sudden the answer comes to us. Well, where does it come from? Right. It comes from our subconscious awareness that is smarter than us. I mean, we don't like to think about it that way, but the dumb one on top is us. And everything below in our subconscious is smarter than we are. It's why our gut reactions are our gut reactions, because they know what's right for our lives versus, you know, the thinking awareness on top. Well, when you start to dig down deep into that intelligence, you start to get amazing answers to things that you never knew could even be answered. Like, you know, some of the stuff that I came up with, the emotional intelligence and the modeling of human emotions and things like that, is now matching the scientists who've been doing this for 40 years and just put out a, like the Ekmans just put out an atlas of human emotions that is hand in glove, exactly the same model that I put out, where I was just kind of like, this is how kind of it works. And I got that from the subconscious intelligence within me. And I was just able to evoke that through work of, you know, being able to dive into my consciousness, et cetera. And now it turns out that the models that I'm creating are the best models that we have to create artificial emotional intelligence and understand how we're going to be able to get computers to simulate human emotions and understand real human emotions in human users and be able to react to that in an emotionally intelligent way. It's like, it's just kind of cool that you dig down into your own existence. And your intelligence, I don't care how smart you think you are, your intelligence level, when you start digging down into that, you're going to blow yourself away at how much intelligence is below the surface of your own mind that you didn't even know existed. And so if you dig into that, that's kind of what I did. And so that's kind of how I got to where I was. I was like, well, this sucks. I have everything I want. This sucks, right? So that's not the standard reaction that you would have. But then I was like, okay, what's next? And so then I started digging deep, and then that's when I found, holy cow, there's a whole, like, the operating system that we're working on as human beings is infinitesimally small and unintelligent in comparison to what you have underneath the covers. And if you can dig into that and get into that, your life becomes amazing from that moment forward, and you're in complete control of absolutely everything, which is really cool.
Your story is similar to, do you know Vishen Lakhiani?
No, I don't.
From Mind Valley, young guy who went to school and became an engineer and went to work at Microsoft and had the same kind of epiphany, shall we say, at Bill Gates' house while having a barbecue for new hires.
Oh, and yeah, realized, I remember.
I do not want to be here. I do not want to do this.
Yes.
And now he's doing very similar work, and bringing together all sorts of people. Actually, he would be, his podcast would be fabulous for you to be on.
What's it called?
At Mind Valley.
All right.
Yeah, yeah, because he's got a massive audience, and this is right. Very, very similar story to yours there.
Awesome.
Excellent. So tell us where people can find you and find out about your books and all that you're doing for the world.
Sure. Well, it's easy. There's a one-stop shop for that. I mean, you can go to Amazon or you can go to Audible and get the books. And that's, I mean, if you're interested in understanding what your mind can do past what you think it can do now, that's probably the place you want to start, is just go download the Audible book or go to Amazon and get the book and read it. It's getting decent reviews, and some Navy SEALs have stepped up to say that it's the best mind training on the planet so far that they'd found, nice. Which is kind of cool. Yeah, we're doing a podcast together now. It's really crazy. Called Two Seals and a Walrus. It's a very adult podcast. Warning, asterisk, you know, yeah. Flashing lights. But yeah, they stepped up and said, this stuff is amazing and we want to help share it out. But you can go either to those places and get the book, or you can go to mindhackinghappiness.com. We're going to be starting to put out some more videos and things like that. And if you're interested, you can check out Two Seals and a Walrus podcast, which we're less than 20 episodes in, but we've started to gather some pretty amazing guests on the podcast so far who are in this space of, you know, digging deeper and figuring out the deeper truth of our humanity and things like that. Like we had Roger Nelson from the PEAR Project and from the Global Consciousness Project on. He spent over an hour with us talking about how to meditate and influence random number generators, which is amazing. We just had Joe Rogan's favorite guest, Randall Carlson, on, who wants to already come on again because we had such a fun time. We're having a good time with it. So you can check any of those places out.
That's fabulous. And do you have one last piece of advice for the Careers by Jen listener?
Yeah. If you want to improve your work life, or any portion of your life, really, you want to be a better parent, you want to be a better spouse, you want to be a better lover, you want to be a better human being, you want to be a better, happier person, dig deeper within your own mind. Understand what's going on in there so that you can sidestep the distractions that your mind would normally give you that would set you off your path, so that you can just step right around those things and stay on the path that makes you the happiness, because you have the ability to do it. You just got to learn how to do it and then practice doing it, and then your brain will actually help you do it. So that would be my advice.
Fabulous. Well, Sean, thank you so much for taking the time today and for sharing your wisdom out with us. It's been great.
Thank you, Jen. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Careers by Jen with Jen Swanson. If you like what you heard, please share this. You know, if every single person listening today shared this episode with just one friend, our audience would be twice as big, just like that. And the more people we can help with our content, the better. So help out a friend and help grow our audience by sharing this show with someone you know who would benefit from the content. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do that, and together we can make a difference. Until next time, take good care.